Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the second in our series on medieval thinkers. Tonight's talk on Ibn Ezra, and it's a pleasure to have Rav Nadi Helfgott with us. He's here, of course, for the weekend, our Renewing Our Spirit conference, which is taking place Saturday night and Sunday at Sher Shemaim. And of course, once he was here, we're taking advantage. He's, of course, an expert in Tanakh and Parshanut. He's the chairman of the departments of Tanakh and Jewish thought at Chovevei Torah. And he teaches at SAR, which is the high school in Riverdale. And just 11 days ago, he was installed as the rabbi of Netivot HaShalom, I believe is the name of the shul, in Teaneck, New Jersey. So he's joining the ranks of the pulpit rabbis, and he'll be a wonderful addition. He has a long history of involvement in education. He edited the book of the Rav's letters. He's written articles. He's edited like volumes of the Orthodox Forum. He serves on all the committees and all the important organizations dealing with Jewish education. And he's a master educator, and it's a pleasure to welcome him and to have him for the weekend. Rabbi Nadi Helfgott.
Thank you, Rabbi Jay. It's a pleasure once again to be here in Toronto. It's an annual trip. My wife always knows that I'm going away sometime in November for Jay Kelman, and it's wonderful to be here. I hope you understand my accent, and I hope we enjoy learning together this evening. Let me give out some sheets. Most of the material is in Ivrit, but I'm going to translate everything that we do. And I'll just want to sketch out what I'm like to do tonight. And please feel free to ask questions if something's unclear or something's not clear. And then at the end, please feel free to share and comment, whatever you'd like to do. So I'd like to start with a little bit of biographical information about Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra has a certain kind of dmut, a certain kind of image in some circles of Orthodox Judaism. So instead of just having an image, about him, I'd like to get into the kishkes of what his approach to Tanakh was. That's really my goal tonight. Because Ibn Ezra was a real polymath. He was a person who was both, he was a mathematician, he was an astrologer of sorts, he was a person who was interested in all kinds of various areas of science. He also was a person who loved diktuk and wrote many books of diktuk, of grammar. He wrote many versions of his commentary on Tanakh. We do not have all of the versions. We only have some of the versions of what he wrote. And he was a person who had lots of interests. Like many of the Jews in Spain, during the golden age of Spain, he had many, many interests. Tonight, I would just like to focus on his Parshanut, on his biblical commentary, which is really the most famous area for us today. But as I said, one could write about many other things and talk about many other things related to Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra also came from a very famous family. The Ibn Ezras, the Ben Ezras, were a very famous family. Moshe Ibn Ezra and other Ibn Ezras, they were in the family business of writing on grammar and writing poetry and doing all those things that for some people today, it's kind of unimaginable. Rabbis writing poetry. Today, thank God, we have a little bit more. We have people like Rav Sabato in Israel writing novels, right, and stuff like that. But, it's not so common that you have Ba'alei HaMisora, pillars of the tradition, writing love poetry, writing piyutim, writing on Tanakh and Gemara, but they were much more broad than many today are. But that was the reality of Spain at that time. Ibn Ezra lives, in terms of the timing, just to get Ibn Ezra lives basically from the latter third of the 11th century, 1069. According to most, he was born somewhere around 1069. And he he died in the early part of the 12th century, somewhere around 1140, 1150. It's unclear exactly, somewhere around that time. Now, Ibn Ezra also had a very rough life. He did not have it easy. He did not have it, he didn't live with a silver spoon in his mouth. In fact, part of that, if you can say that, has a silver lining. Because Ibn Ezra, as opposed to many of the other great Arabic commentators and great Arabic linguists and poets who were more successful economically and therefore didn't have to travel, Ibn Ezra ended up having to travel, which meant that he ended up in Ashkenazic communities for a large part of the latter part of his life, which meant that he wrote his commentaries in Hebrew rather than Arabic, which meant that it was left for posterity in much more than many other great scholars who we don't really know that much about, because many of their writings went down into oblivion because nobody redeemed them by translating them into Ivrit. And so when the golden age of Spain ended, so there were these great names that many of you have never even heard of. Rabbi Yehuda ibn Chayuj. Who's that? Is that something you put in, you know, on a spice, on chicken or something? No, that's Chawaj. But Rabbi Yehuda ibn Chayuj, one of the greatest medaktikim ever. And yet his books went to oblivion because we don't really know him, because it was all written in Arabic. Later on, we discovered them again in manuscripts, and scholars can write PhDs about it. But the average Jew or the average kid in day school never heard of Rabbi Yehuda ibn Chayuj. Who's that? But Ibn Ezra, thank God, with all his adversity, I think in one poem he writes about the fact that, you know, if I'm not mistaken, unless I'm confusing with somebody else, but if I went into the area of burying the dead would stop dying. You know, that, which is a kind of Yiddish joke also. I think later on in history there's a Yiddish joke like that. Anyway, so Ibn Ezra had it rough, and that's why it's so interesting. But you have to remember that Ibn Ezra was fashioned by his early experiences, like so many of us are, right? Like the Jews who came from Europe, and even though they've been living in America for 50 years, whatever, they're European Shayidin, right? They're European Jews. He was fashioned by his experiences, his confrontation with Karaites. Now, there were no Karaites in the middle of Ashkenaz. Rashi and, you know, and people who living in France and Germany, there weren't that many Karaites. But the Karaites were a very serious threat in Spain. But Ibn Ezra writes about the Karaites as if they're in front of him. Even though the last 20, 30 years of his life, he probably, you know, couldn't meet a Karaite, you know, to save his life. There was no Karaites around. But that was what fashioned his intellectual reality, was what he had learned as a young man, as a kid and as a young man, where he had been fashioned intellectually. I'd like tonight to speak about four aspects of Ibn Ezra's Parshanut HaMikra, Ibn Ezra's biblical exegesis, which are critical to understanding where he came from. I'd like to analyze his derech of Parshanut. What was his approach to kind of the central questions of what a biblical commentator is supposed to do? And that will take, we'll call that one and two. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about his attitude to issues of specific examples of Peshat and Drash, of the tension between the traditional interpretations and the more plain sense interpretations. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the whole very interesting question about Ibn Ezra and his relationship to what we might call today biblical criticism, or kind of questions about the Torah and the authorship of the Torah, which is the most controversial. If anyone's ever read Chaim Potok's novel, In the Beginning. Remember In the Beginning? Chaim Potok's novels, it always is the same theme, right? You have somebody who, a young man, who starts very religious and ends up very not so religious, but because he's had some sort of epiphany, because he's learned something. It's usually either he's learned something or he's experienced something. So In the Beginning, you know, the Chosen was about someone who came in contact with academic Talmud study, right? So In the Beginning is someone who came into contact with academic Bible study, who had grown up in the yeshiva and came in contact. So, and the first thing he learns that kind of throws him off kilter is he reads the Hertz Chumash, and in the back are the essays where Hertz tries to slug up, tries to respond to the Bible critics. And one of the things he talks about is Ibn Ezra. And so the young man in the book goes to find out about Ibn Ezra in the library. That's how the story. And he starts with, so I'd like to talk a little bit about Ibn Ezra's attitude and the dmut, the image that emerged from that. So I'd like to start with the foundational principle of his Parshanut HaMikra. But to understand that, we have to understand the world of Sephardic Parshanut, of Sephardic exegesis in contrast to Ashkenazi exegesis. And when I mean Ashkenazi exegesis, I want to highlight specifically Rashi and Rashbam. Rashi and Rashbam, each in their own way, this is not the lecture about Rashi and Rashbam, but Rashi and Rashbam fundamentally approached the Bible based on a very famous comment of the rabbis. The rabbis, in a famous Talmudic comment in Masechet Sanhedrin, write, based on a verse in Mishlei, I think, Uchefati shifotzei tzela, that God's word is like a hammer hitting a rock, that it shoots out in different directions. And what that means, and the rabbis there say, Mikra echad yotzei lekama te'amim, ve'ein kama te'amim yotzim mimikra echad, which is a fundamental rabbinic principle, that one verse can teach me many things. I can interpret the same verse on many different levels, at the same time, using different methodologies, and they're all true. They kind of exist in parallel universes, right? This kind of, you know, like Star Trek, there's the two Kirks, and there's the, you know, Bizarro world in comic books. They all exist at the same time. And as opposed to many things being learned from one verse. The same thing being learned from many verses. The rabbis did not like the fact, what do I need this verse if I already have another verse to teach me this law of Shabbat or that law of Kashrut? They believed in what's called omnisignificance. Every word has to teach me something. So why do I need three verses to teach me the same thing? It must be that there's three different things being taught here. But the rabbis went further, and the rabbis said each verse can be understood on multiple levels of meaning, each of which are true at the same time, existing on two different levels. That was the fundamental Ashkenazic approach. Peshat and Drash, for example, the plain sense of the text, and the drash, which is the more expansive sense of the text, are both true. I'm not going to give value judgments. One is better, one is worse. They both exist, but on different levels. They use different methodologies to achieve their goals, but they're both true. The Ibn Ezra and the Rambam and all the other great Sfaradi, Parshanim, and Halachis fundamentally came from a different angle. They came from the angle that a text, it sounds very much like, you know, literary theory today, many of the debates about literary theory today. They fundamentally came from the perspective that a text means one thing, and that's it. Now, how do you determine what a text means? So fundamentally, it all goes back to Sa'adya Gaon, Rav Sa'adya Gaon. Rav Sa'adya Gaon, in a very famous comment in his Emunot V'Deot, writes that a biblical text should always be interpreted as it says, kimashma'o, as it sounds, literally, except if it contradicts one of four principles. Number one, if it goes against empirical evidence, what you see in front of you. Number two, if it goes against rationality, because rationality by the early Middle Ages was lifted up as the end-all and be-all judgment of truth. Number three, if it goes against another verse, so something's got to give. Either verse A has to be reinterpreted, or verse B has to be reinterpreted. One has to be, right? Or four, what they called HaKabbalah HaNe'emana, authentic tradition. Because we don't only know things by what we see or what we can figure out. We also know things by authentic tradition. I never met Napoleon Bonaparte. Never met him. But, right? But I was told that he exists. How do I know he exists? I don't know. Maybe he did. Because I have a tradition which I trust that the people telling me really that he existed. That's called Kabbalah Ne'emana. Only if the verse contradicts one of those four principles am I entitled to interpret it differently. So, for example, the example that Sa'adya Gaon loves to give about the senses is it says that she was called Chava, she was called Eve, ki hi haita aim kol chai. because she was the mother of all living beings. That's not true. Kangaroos do not come from women. Little cats, kittens are not born from male females. So you must reinterpret that verse. You have to read it as if it says, "Ki ayta ein kol chai shel bnei ha'adam," of mankind, not of all living beings. It's a hyperbole. It's not literal. You're not taking it literally. Or when it says, "Umaltem et orlat levavchem," and you shall circumcise the covering of your heart. It doesn't mean that there's a mitzvah to get a bypass operation. That's ridiculous. It's not what God intends. Okay? It means open up your heart to God. Okay. Or things that go against rational assumptions about the nature of God, the nature of the world. So when it says that God is an esh ochlahu, that God is a consuming fire, but fire is something that has a beginning and an end. But God, based on my first assumptions about the nature of God, doesn't have a beginning and end, can't be put out, so can't be literal. Okay? So this is where they come from. Someone like Ibn Ezra was raised in his mother's milk on those assumptions, those exegetical assumptions of how you approach the biblical text, that the text means one thing, and it always means what it says, unless one of these four criteria haven't been met. And then you have to determine what are you going to do. You can't simply say, "Oh, this is pshat, this is drash." You have to somehow try to show that if you take the drash, if you take the rabbinic tradition or the rabbinic exegesis as authentic truth, then somehow you have to show how it really fits into the text. So this is where I'd like to start. I'd like to take a quick look at the Ibn Ezra, a couple of lines from the Ibn Ezra's Hakdama, his introduction to the Bible. He wrote two versions of his Perush. One of them we have most of it, one of them we don't have most of it. This is from the introduction. And you see already what he says. He starts with a poem. B'shem ha'el ha'gadol ha'nora, achel ha'faresh Perush ha'Torah. In the name of God, the great God, I will start to write a Torah. It's very Arabic. You ever heard an Arabic speaker? He starts, right? In the name of the merciful, of the, you know, Allah, you know, Rahami, right? In the name. This is a very Arabic beginning. Ana Elohe Avi Avraham, Aseh Chesed Im Avdecha Avraham. So do Chesed. And then look at the last two bold lines. Zeha Sefer HaYashar. This is the straight book, La Avraham HaShar, to Abraham the poet. Today we would say Mishorer. Uba'avotot hadikduk nikshar, and I am bound by the bonds, by the ropes of grammar. Ube'enei hada'at yikshar, and I will follow rationality. So the Ibn Ezra right here throws down the gauntlet. And he says that his perush, his commentary on the Bible, is going to be predicated on two principles. One is that the text has to make sense according to biblical grammar. And two, it has to make sense according to rationality. And so therefore, if the Bible does not say that a miracle took place, don't bring miracles into the Bible. Don't bring supernaturalism into the Bible except where it's explicit. He comes here straight from the Spanish rationalist tradition. And he comes, of course, from the emphasis of dikduk, which led him to reject many of Rashi's interpretations. Because Rashi, for example, believed in certain grammar principles, which by the time Ibn Ezra came along, were proven to be not true. Because dikduk, the study of Hebrew grammar, was much more developed in the Arabic lands than it was in Ashkenazi lands. To give you an example, Rashi believed that Hebrew language could have roots of one letter, which is not correct in terms of biblical Hebrew. But already 200 years before that, in the Arabic lands, people like Rabbi Yehuda ibn Chayuj and Rabbi Yona ibn Janach and all the great Midaktikim had proved that Hebrew has three-letter roots. And that's as we all learn in day school, Shoresh. But those works were not translated into Hebrew, and Rashi could not read Arabic. That's why the only The only, if you've ever studied Rashi, the only grammar books that Rashi quotes are Menachem Bechiburo and Dunash ibn Librat, who lived 200-300 years before Yonah ibn Janach. But things that developed in the history of grammar and dikduk, which Rashi had no access to, because Menachem wrote in Hebrew and Dunash ibn Librat wrote in Hebrew. But Yonah ibn Janach was not translated till 200 years after Rashi was dead. So he didn't have access to that. But Ibn Ezra had access because he read Arabic. So this is the pillar of his interpretative stance. And then he lays out five approaches to interpreting the Bible, four of which he rejects, and the fifth, of course, which is the good guys, Ibn Ezra himself. I just want to read one or two lines from each derech that he rejects. So he starts the paragraph. Haderech ha'achat arukah urechova, ומנפשות אנשי דרינו נשגבה, והאם האמת כנקודה בתוך העגולה, זאת הדרך כקו הרחב והחוטה סובב בתחילה. So he writes here about a very, very complicated approach to the Bible, which tries to throw in the kitchen sink and everything else to the interpretation of the Bible. And he refers here, he says in the second line, ובדרכו גדולים והם החכמי הישיבות במלכות ישמעאלים כרב יצחק. He talks about there were great scholars, Jewish scholars in Arabic lands, in the Gaonic times, who used to write these gigantic commentaries on the Bible. But what they did was, today we would call it interdisciplinary. They would throw in science, and they would try to throw in math and astronomy into the Perush. You know, like these guys today, like Nathan Aviezer and Gerald Schroeder, that want to show, right, how basically the Big Bang is in chapter 1 of Genesis, right? That's what they did. And he says this is not the way to approach the Bible. To try to write mathematical commentaries and astronomic commentaries, you're not going to end up with anything worthwhile ultimately, because you're going to just bring in too much extraneous material to try to put together all of these things, and it's not going to end up well. Look at the bottom of the page. The second approach is the approach of the Karaites. Haderech hashniya bacharu taltulim, those who are off the derech, so to speak. Ve'im hem Yisraelim asher chashvu ki yamdu al nekuda ba'atzma, ve'hem lo yadu et mekoma. Ve'zed derech hatzedukim. This is the approach of the Karaites. Ke'anan u'binyamin u'ben Mashiach v'yashua, ve'chein kol min asher b'divrei ma'atikei hada'at lo yamin. This refers to those who don't believe in the tradition of the rabbis. Meaning, they're willing to interpret the Bible, but they give no credence to the authentic tradition that Jews have going back to Sinai. What's the third approach? Turn the page. The third approach is a reference to the Christians. Haderech HaShlishi, Derech Choshech Va'afela, the way of darkness. V'himi chutz l'kav ha'agula, it's out of the circle. V'heim ha'bod'im milibam l'chol ha'dvarim sodot. Those are the people who make up and claim that the Bible should be read allegorically, that everything has a hidden meaning, which is the classical Christological reading of the Bible. So the Seir la'azazel, the scapegoat that the Kohen offers on Yom Kippur, is really a symbolism for Jesus, who takes upon himself the sins of the people. Or when Moses went up and prayed on behalf of the Jewish people for Amalek, and his hands were up there, that's Jesus on the cross. That's why he's holding his hands up. This is the Christological, allegorical interpretation of the Bible. The emunatam ki atorot v'amishpatim chidot, they believe that the Torah and the laws are riddles. V'lo a'arich la'ashiv lahem. I won't spend a lot of time in my commentary responding to them. Ki am to'ei levavhem, because they are a wayward people. And he goes on in that context. But then what's very beautiful is the next line, he says. He says, that a person should use his rationality to understand what's going on in the Bible. V'im hadat lo tizbol hadavar. If your rationality does not accept what you're hearing, az yivakesh lo so. The only time that you should allow yourself to interpret something allegorically is if it doesn't fit in with rationality and with dict, right? Well, everything we said. And then he says a beautiful line. Ki shikul hadat hu hayesod. The judgment of one's rational faculty is the foundation. Ki lo nitna ha-Torah la-asher ein datlo. God did not give the Bible to someone who has no knowledge. V'hamalach ben adam u'ben elokav hu sichlo. And the angel that connects man and God is his rational faculty. This is like the best motto. If I wanted to get one line from the Middle Ages to express what the rationalists believe, that's it. Hamalach ben adam u'ben elokav hu sichlo. That which bonds man to God is very strong stuff. And then he writes about the fourth approach, which is getting closer to the truth. Haderech harevi'it krova el hanikuda, the next paragraph. V'radfu acharei aguda, zot derech hachachamim ba'artzot yivanim va'adumim. This is a reference to the Christian scholars. The Jewish scholars who live in Christian lands, like Rashi. Shelo yabitu el mishkal moznaim. They don't spend too much time figuring out the diktuk. Rak yismechu al derech drash kelekach tov or einayim. They just like to quote midrashim. You know rabbis like that. They just quote midrashim. The little midrash says. The big midrash says. They just like, but they don't analyze. Does it fit into the context of the story? Does it fit into the language of the text? And then he gets to his derech. Haderech hachamishit. He says, this is my fifth approach. Mosad perush alei yishit, which I've set up my commentary. V'hi ha-yishara be'inai, and this is the one that seems best in my eyes. Nochach p'nei Hashem, in front of God. Asher mimenu levado ira. It's a beautiful motto also. God alone I will fear. No one else. V'lo esa panim b'toran. I will not show favoritism. Just because some medrash says it doesn't mean I have to accept it. So he says, how am I going to approach a text? One, achapes heitev digduk kol mila b'chol me'odi. Number one, I'm going to figure out what fits in with dikduk. What fits in with dikduk, with grammar. And then he says, as follows. Skip to where it says the footnote 142. And he says, I'm not going to get involved in all kinds of drushot. Ibn Ezra didn't like many of the drushot he heard. I don't mean drushot like the rabbi's drushot. I mean the exegetical derivations that often, for example, there's all kinds of interesting midrashim. How come here there's an extra vav? How come here it says Yirmiyah versus Yirmiyahu, Yeshaya versus Yeshayahu? So he says that's the nature of the language of Hebrew. Don't make a big deal out of that. That stuff is not real. But then he says something very important. He says Uba'avur hadrash derech hapshat einenu sara ki shivim panim l'torah. So when it comes to peshat, the plain sense of the text, you don't throw away the plain sense of the text because someone has a nice drasha. Someone has a nice drasha. That's all in narrative. In the narrative part of the Bible. However, rak b'torot u'b'mishpatim u'b'chukim. But when it comes to the legal material of the Bible, im matzanu shnei ta'amim la'psukim. If we find two interpretations of the verse, and you have to weigh which one is correct and which one is not correct, v'hatam ha'echad kidivrei ha'ma'atikim, and one of them follows the tradition of the rabbis, shayu kulam tzadikim, nish'an ala mitam b'li safek b'yadayim chazakim. We will rely upon authentic tradition. So the Ezra here is not some radical. He's not saying, he's saying, in general, I'm going to follow what Diktuk says. And I'm going to not fear anybody. And I'm going to give original interpretations. And we'll see some of them. But that's all in the narrative. When it comes to the halachic portions of Chumash, the rabbis had authentic tradition. And therefore, I'm going to give great weight to that. If I have to weigh what the interpretation is, I'm going to give great weight to the rabbinic interpretation of halacha. Now, what's left a little bit unclear is what happens when the rabbinic interpretation is really, really difficult. It really doesn't fit with the diktuk. And it really doesn't fit with everything else with that in the context. What do you do then? So the Ibn Ezra, like most people, is a little bit inconsistent. But he basically has three approaches to deal with really, really difficult pesukim that it doesn't fit well, the rabbinic interpretation. And he basically does the following three things. Number one, he will try to show that the rabbinic interpretation is also the pshat, is actually the pshat. And very often he's successful. He'll show you by quoting other verses in the Bible. He'll show you by showing how the diktuk works out that I can really fit it in. Because again, as opposed to Rashbam or Rashi, that the text can speak on two levels at the same time, the text can't. If you want to know the true meaning of the text, you have to figure out, it has to be one meaning. And if that one meaning contradicts the rabbinic interpretation, which I hold is true, I'm a tsaris. I'm in trouble. Because there is no, you can't say the text says this and the text says this at the same time. No. The text says one thing. So his first approach is to try to put them together and work it out. When that is unsuccessful, he has two other approaches which he'll often use, which will lead him to some radical conclusions. One is, which is also used by Maimonides when he doesn't like something in Chazal, and that's to call it a dat yachid. For example, the Rambam writes in a number of places in the Moreh HaNevuchim, in the Guide for the Perplexed, that you know, this and this belief that you find in a Gemara here, it's a dat yachid, it's a minority position. Shadim. Yeah, there were rabbis who believed in demons, but that's a minority position. Guess what? It's not a minority position. I mean, they really believed in demons in Babylonia. The Rambam didn't believe in demons, and you don't want the rabbis in totality to be against you, so you reinterpret. Did the Rambam do a sociological count, a study of ancient Babylonia, how many rabbis actually believed? No, of course not. He didn't have the tools to do that. But when you want to say that a shita is a shita dechuya, a rejected approach, you want to, okay. Ibn Ezra does that as well sometimes. Certain difficult passages, which are so difficult to fit into the diktuk, he'll say, you know what, that halacha is a dat yachid. Meaning, the derivation of that halacha from that pasuk, from that verse, is not really where they got it from. They got it from tradition. There's a Torah Sheba'al Peh that exists independent of Torah Shebichtav. And the third thing Ibn Ezra will do often, and this has to do with drashot, laws that were derived by all kinds of exegetical inferences which don't fit into diktuk, the Ibn Ezra will say, the drash is really what we call in Hebrew an asmachta. It's really just a hook to connect the received law to the text. But the rabbis didn't really believe that's the meaning of the text. The rabbis knew this by tradition. So for Ibn Ezra, in the famous question of did the drashot create the law, or did the drashot, do they just show, they're trying to connect a law that already existed by tradition. Ibn Ezra took the position of tradition. Many of the laws that we keep, the rabbis didn't really derive it from the text. They had it in tradition. But they wanted a hook. But then, if it's a hook, I don't have to force myself to interpret it as the pshat of the pasuk. So this is the first comment I wanted to make about Ibn Ezra. The second comment is how much he was affected by the literary theory of his day in interpreting the biblical text. Turn the page. I'm not going to read all this. I just want to read a couple of lines from a very famous Ibn Ezra, probably one of the most famous Ibn Ezras in his commentary. Ibn Ezra struggles with the famous question that we make reference to every Friday night. Right? Every Friday night we like to sing Shamor V'Zachor V'Dibur Echad Ne'emru, which is a reference to, of course, what? What's it a reference to? The two versions of the Ten Commandments of the Aseret HaDibrot. Now the two versions of the Ten Commandments have slight differences. The most famous Zachor V'Shamor, but there are many other differences as well. And the question is, what do you do with those differences? So Rashi, very famously, taking the approach of one Midrash, says, both were said at the same time, Shamor V'Zachor B'Dibur Echad Ne'emru, right? They were said at the same time, something that the ear can't hear. But that's not the simple reading. The simple reading is, no. Simple reading is, the real version that God said is the version in Shmot. And what's the version in Devarim? Why do we find differences? Why do we find differences? Because why? What do you mean the timing? Because it's 38 years later when Moses is recapping. This is the paraphrase of Moses to the Aseret HaDibrot. And Moses chose to change and don't make a big deal out of it. Now we are so raised on Rashi and the staple of Midrashim. What do you mean don't make a big deal about it? That's exactly the essence of exegesis. Slight differences are very significant. But Ibn Ezra came from a different literary theory. Let's read his literary theory. Look at the bottom of the page on the second column. Ibn Ezra says here something startling that will, you know, shock you. Or maybe not shock you so much. Depends how shocked you get about things. Bottom of the page, second column. Amar Abraham HaMechaber, said Abraham the writer. Mishpat Anshei Lashon HaKodesh, the nature of those who speak the Holy Tongue, meaning the nature of biblical Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, there's no such thing as Lashon Kodesh is Yiddish in Hebrew. There's no such thing as Lashon Hara either. Correct Hebrew is Lashon Hara. But you say that to anybody, they don't know what you're talking about. So you have to say Lashon Hara. Right? So Lashon Kodesh. So Mishpat Anshei Lashon HaKodesh, the nature of biblical Hebrew is that sometimes they'll say things at length, and sometimes they'll say the same thing in short words. In medieval Hebrew, they didn't say milim, they said milot. That was the plural. So that the hearer can understand what they want to say, what they want to mean. V'dat, now here comes the key word. Here's his literary theory. Ki hamilot hem kigufot. The words of the Bible are like the clothes that a human being wears. V'hat ta'amim, now ta'amim, need a little background. In medieval Hebrew, the word ta'am did not mean taste. And the word ta'am did not mean reason. The word ta'am meant perush, meaning. So he says the words are like the body, kigufot, v'hata'amin kineshamot, and the meaning is like the soul, the essence, v'haguf l'neshama, the body to the soul who kamo kli, is like a garment. Al kein mishpat kol hachamim b'chol hashem. Now you notice he goes from Hebrew to all languages. He says biblical Hebrew is just like every other language in the world. So he said, Al tein mishpat kol hachamim b'chol lashon shishmeru ha-ta'amim. The nature of exalted language spoken by the scholars, meaning not the common language spoken by people in the street, but elevated language, literary language, is that it tries to maintain the meaning ve'einam choshishim mishinui hamilot. And they don't make a big deal out of changing words. Achar shehem shavot
b'ta'amam, once they are equivalent in meaning. Ve'etein l'cha dimyonot. I'm going to give you some examples. Amar Hashem l'kayin. God said to Cain, Arura ta min adama. You are cursed from the land. So God actually said X. Now Cain, when he summarizes what God said to him, who thinks that because Cain said a little differently, it means something different? Now what do you mean, who thinks? I'll tell you who thinks. Rashi, Chazal, the Medrash. That's the whole essence of the exegetical assumptions of the Medrash. That little changes are a big deal. Anybody that ever studied, and it's interesting, today modern literary theory is more like the Medrash, not like Ibn Ezra. Meaning we make a big deal. That's what's called close reading. Nechama Leibovitz and everybody else who studied with her, Zichron Livracha, and everybody else, we all make a big deal, right? We just had the story of Avraham sending the Eved to get Rivka, to get a wife for Yitzchak. And right, everybody asks, how come the Bible spends so much time? First it tells the story, and then it retells the story in the mouth of the Eved. And so everybody makes a big deal about the fact that, you know what, because you see the little differences in how he told the story, is you see how his agenda, that he wanted to make sure that Rivka would come with him, and so therefore he leaves certain things out, he adds certain things, right? He doesn't tell them this, but he does tell them that. He changes. Now, Ibn Ezra on that story says, don't make a big deal about these things. That's just the way it is. You retell a story. Just like when you and I retell a story, we leave out some things. It's not necessarily that we have a big agenda. Sometimes we just forget. Sometimes we emphasize certain things. Sometimes, that's what he says. And he gives another five examples like this. And therefore he says the same thing here. If you look towards the bottom of the page, he says, Da, you see where in bold it says, Vaydaber Elohim et kol hadvarim eileh. He says, Da ki aseret hadvarim, right before that. The Ten Commandments, Kashem tuvim b'parashah zot, as they're written here in Shmot, Hashem amaram kulam, God alone said them. Ki katu vaydaber elokim et kol hadvarim eileh. Utchilatam anochi v'sofam v'chol asher l'reyecha. V'gam Moshe amar ka'asher hizkir aseret hadvarim b'shenit et hadvarim eileh yidaber. Moses also said they heard all of them. And he says later on, he says the version that we have in Devarim is Moshe's version, where he was simply paraphrasing what God had told him 38 years ago. And don't make a big deal about it. Zohar and Shamar are synonymous. They don't mean two different things in biblical Hebrew. And he goes on and on and on. But what's fascinating is he believes that the Bible is a literary document. Now, literary is not a bad or good, it's a neutral word. All it means is, to use rabbinic language, Dibra Torah Kilshon B'nei Adam. The Bible speaks in language of human beings. Now, how do you figure out how human beings speak? Well, you got to go study the nature of how human, what's that called? That's called linguistics. That's called literature. Hebrew exists as a language the way human beings speak. Now, how do we know how human beings who spoke biblical Hebrew spoke? By looking at the Bible. And the Bible has certain canons, has certain principles, has certain exegetical assumptions. It has inverted parallelism and chiastic structure and anticipatory parallelism, you know. But the only way you could do it is figure out. But he assumes that it's a literary document. Now, today, we have a different literary theory. But that doesn't change the fact that Ibn Ezra assumed the Bible is a literary document. And that was a big thing. Meaning, it's not some sort of, you know, Eish Shechor al Eish Levana that it somehow can't be unlocked by human, rational exegesis. That's the assumption here. And this is based, we don't have the time now, but it's based on Arabic study of the Quran. The Arab, the same Arabic scholars of that period said the same thing about the Quran and about their texts, their sacred texts. And this was the belief very strongly that God speaks in the language of human beings. And not only that, but he speaks in the highest language of human beings. You know, God doesn't speak like, you know, some kid on the street. He speaks exalted, high, epic language with poetry and prose, and you have to figure out how to unpack it. Now, as I mentioned before, just to give you one example about the Pshat and Drash, the Ibn Ezra, as I said, was very respectful of the rabbinic interpretation. But, and therefore, for example, while some commentaries like the Rashbam, when it comes to the Pasuk of Tefillin, Ukshartem La'ot Ayadecha, said that on a Peshat level it's metaphoric. On a Drash level it means Tefillin, a little box with words in it. But there's also a Peshat level which is metaphoric. Put this on your heart, put this on your soul, think about God all the time. Ibn Ezra rejected that entirely. So if you turn to the next page, so Ibn Ezra says that there were those who interpreted to fill in the top line, Al derech ki liviat chein heim l'roshecha v'anakim l'gurotecha v'gam kshartem lota yedecha kemo kashrem aluach libecha. There are those who said that the words ukshartem lota yedecha is like the verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs, put the words on your heart. It's not literal. So Ibn Ezra goes crazy. This is not a correct approach. You can't compare the writings in Sefer Shmot to the book of Proverbs. Because Proverbs, it says, these are the Proverbs of Solomon, which are to be interpreted metaphorically. Many of the verses there are interpreted metaphorically. But God forbid the Torah should be read allegorically or metaphorically. It always should be interpreted literally unless, as I said, one of the five principles doesn't fit. Four principles. Alkein lo notzienu miyad pshuto. Therefore, we will not remove it from its plain sense. When it's in its plain sense, when it doesn't contradict rationality, only if it goes against rationality do we have to reinterpret it. But if it doesn't, I'm going to take it literally. So it literally means put something here on your arm and on your head. And in this instance, there is no contradiction. It doesn't contradict rationality to say that God asked us to put a box on our hand. Ibn Ezra's not willing to say, it means this and it means that. It can mean X and Y at the same time. And they're not contradictory. Because here, it's not like it's contradictory. You could say it means X on a pshat level and it means Y on a drash. That's exactly what the Rashbam would say. Or Rash. No. It's got to mean one thing. On the other hand, you got to turn it like this. Unfortunately, it was Xerox the wrong way. When it comes to narrative, Ibn Ezra is willing to contradict very, very well-known rabbinic interpretations. For example, many of you know that one of the strands in the rabbis say that Isaac was 37 when the Akedah happened, which is based on certain assumptions. For example, what are the assumptions based on? It's based on the fact that the Bible tells us that Sarah had Isaac when she was 90. The Bible also tells us that Sarah died when she was 127. The Bible presents the death of Sarah right after, or a little bit after, the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. So the rabbis, in classic Midrashic fashion, claim that Sarah died because of the news of the Akedah. Never says that in the Bible, but this is a classical rabbinic smichut parshiot. Because someone like Sarah can't just die of old age. Can't just die of old age. If she died, and she died 50 years before her husband, why did she die 50 years before? If she was younger than her husband, why did she die 50 years before her husband? Women live longer than men, right, today. So why did she die? So there must be some reason. So there's a rabbinic mind here is working very strongly. And it sees the juxtaposition of stories, but the pshat doesn't fit. The pshat doesn't fit for many reasons. Just one At the end of the Akedah, Abraham goes back to what city? What does it say there? Be'er Sheva, in the south, which is where the Avod hung out. Look at Yitzchak. All the time they were in the south. But where does Sarah die? In Hebron. So what happened? Abraham is in Be'er Sheva and Sarah's in Hebron. What's going on? They were living in Be'er Sheva right before the Akedah. That's what it says. Avimelech, remember the story right before the Akedah. And then, so why? What's Abraham? So the Ramban already says, Rashi has a whole thing, but it's difficult. Clearly, the story about the death of Sarah happened many years after Be'er Sheva. They were living in Be'er Sheva, and at a certain point, they moved to Hebron. Why they moved to Hebron? Who knows why they moved to Hebron? People move for all kinds of reasons. Economic reasons, political reasons, social reasons, religious reasons. That's a simple reading. And even Ezra and many others say, there's no juxtaposition. Ramban says, Sarah died many years later. The Akedah doesn't... Also, if you read the Akedah, the sense you get in the Akedah is not of a grown man. He's called Na'ar. Throughout the story, Yitzhak is called Na'ar. He's called a kid. If you open up your concordance, 99.9% of the time, the word Na'ar means a teenager in the Bible. A young teenager. That's what it means, a Na'ar. I'm a kid, I'm a young man. So Ibn Ezra here, for example, says, fourth line, Chazal amru shaya Yitzchak asher nekad ben 37. He was 37. You understand why he's 37? Because she was born when he was born when she was 90. She dies when she's 127. If the Akedah and the death of Sarah happened at the same time, he's 37. That's where they get the cheshbon from. You see that? But he says that's not simple reading. Umiderech svara ein ze nachon. Shehaya ra'ui shetiyeh tzidka Yitzchak gluya. The Bible should have emphasized the godless of Yitzchak. V'yeh tzcharo kaful mitzchar aviv. Shemasar atzmo b'yirtzono l'shchita. V'ein v'katuv me'umal Yitzchak. The Bible doesn't say a word about Yitzchak. That a grown man would give himself up like that. It's not about Yitzchak. We call it Akedas Yitzchak, but the story is all about Abraham. Yitzchak hardly speaks. V'acherim omru shaya ben chamesh shanim. Some say he was a little kid, 5. Gamzelo itachen v'avur shenasat se'olah, because he carried the wood. 5-year-olds can't carry all that wood. V'akarov el hadat, what makes sense, shaya karov l'yud gimel shanim. He was a young teenager, 13. V'chricho aviv akdo shelo b'yirtzono, his father forced him and put him on the Akedah against his will. So he's willing to reject the rabbinic interpretation, even though it was very established and well known, if he didn't think it fit in. The last area I'd like to talk about is the area which made Ibn Ezra... Yes, Rabbi Kelman.
Yeah, sure.
Well, it wasn't so unique in his day and age. Number two, why did it make it into the Mikros?
Yeah, below? It seems ignored today in many circles.
It's basically an accident of history. The person who put together the Mikros was a Jewish Meshumet, a convert, Yaakov ben Chaim, to Christianity, who had access to manuscripts. So he put together whatever he had. Ibn Ezra was famous for being a linguist. And that which he had at his disposal, he put in. Rashi was very famous.
For hundreds of years. I mean, no one's picking him up.
Correct.
And there's so many other things that are
there. There's a lot of things that are there that just they happen to be there. And so it's safe. But it wasn't really studied very carefully, except in certain circles, in Italy and in other places, Ibn Ezra. What's interesting is the Rambam loved Ibn Ezra. Rambam says Ibn Ezra is the greatest commentary on Chumash. In a number of places in his Tshuvot. But, you know, it's an accident of history. So the last issue I'd like to talk about is Ibn Ezra and what gave him the radical, because so far he's not so radical in his time, but that which gave him a radical spin was a number of comments which he made which in certain ways were radical, certainly from the position of that we assume today, based on Maimonides. We, of course, since the time of Maimonides, have been raised to believe that all Jewish thinkers and scholars believe that every single word in the Bible that we have in the Torah, not the Bible, in the Torah, the five books of Moses, were written by Moses, and you can never claim that even one word is post-Mosaic. Meaning, not only do you have to believe that it's divine, that's one belief, you also have to believe that it's Mosaic, from Aleph to Taf. And this is the assumption because of the Rambam. The Rambam says in the eighth principle of faith, we have to believe Shatorah min Hashamayim, that the Bible is divine, and that the text that we have in front of us is exactly the text that came out of the hand of Moses. Rambam was very insistent on that principle. Whether he really meant it or not, so Mark Shapiro has written a lot about this, and people can read about it. But Ibn Ezra, throughout his commentary, drops little hints that he clearly believes that the Bible, that certainly the final edition of the Bible, had post-Mosaic glosses in it. Let's start from the most famous one. A couple of weeks ago, we read that when Abraham came into the land, the Haknani az ba'aretz, and at that moment, the Canaanites were in the land. Now, on a pshat level, it's not a difficult verse. At least I don't believe it's difficult, because Vaknani az ba'aretz could simply mean the Canaanites were then in the land, and therefore Abraham couldn't fulfill the divine destiny of going all over the land and inheriting it. There were other people there, just like today. It wasn't so simple. But Ibn Ezra is troubled by this verse. So if you look on the fourth line on top, last page. Vaknani az ba'aretz yitachen she'eretz k'nan tafsa k'nan miyad acher. So his first interpretation is the Canaanites were then in the land means that at the moment, a few years before Abraham had come in, the Canaanites had just come into the land. So the Bible is telling us a historical fact. The Canaanites had not been in there for centuries. They just came into the land. Okay. But then he says, V'im einenu kein, if it doesn't mean that, yesh lo sod, it has some sort of hidden meaning. V'hamaskil yidom, and the one who is a maskil, the one who understands logic, should be silent. Some sort of mystery surrounding what's so difficult about this verse. So the obvious answer, as all of the commentaries on Ibn Ezra at the time, today there's a revisionist history, but the commentaries in the medieval period understood exactly what Ibn Ezra was driving at. What he's driving at is he's bothered by this verse because he heard in the verse, Vahaknani az ba'aretz, and the Canaanites were then in the land. What's the inference? We're then in the land, but not now, at the time when this verse is being written. Then they were in the land. What do you mean? If Moses wrote this verse, what do you mean? The Canaanites were definitely in the land. Joshua and the subsequent Shoftim had to dislodge the Canaanites from the land. So Ibn Ezra found this verse very disconcerting. He then, if you skip to the bottom of the page, Ibn Ezra, on the last chapter of the Bible, when Moses goes up to the mountain and dies. So you, I'm sure many of you are aware, the rabbis already were troubled. Who wrote the last eight verses of the Bible? So there's a very big debate. One opinion says that Joshua wrote the last eight verses, and one opinion says Moshe wrote it b'nevuah, in prophecy. Rambam says that Moshe wrote it in prophecy. That's how he paskins, because he wants to believe that the whole Torah from A to B, Z, was written by Moses. Ibn Ezra goes further than the Gemara. Ibn Ezra says, Vaya'al Moshe, lefi da'ati, ki mizeh pasuk katvo Yehoshua, ki achar shalom Moshe lo katav. The last 12 verses of the Bible were written by Joshua. So Ibn Ezra already felt free to go beyond the Talmud. Not just when it says Vayamat Moshe, Joshua's writing, but even in the beginning, Moses going up is already being written by Joshua, b'nevuah, in prophecy. And the Ibn Ezra says the same thing at the beginning of Sefer Devarim. If you look, I'm not going to get into the details, but if you look in the middle of the page where it has footnote 15, V'im tavin sod hashneimasar. If you understand the hidden meaning of the 12. For example, the word Vayichtov Moshe and Vaknani Az Ba'aretz. Ba'ar Hashem Yera'eh. Takir Ha'emet. You'll understand the truth. So what's the truth he's referring to? Again, all the super commentaries on the Bible, on the Ibn Ezra, excuse me, in the 13th century, in the 14th century, they all understood what he was driving at. The Sod HaShneimasar refers to the secret of the last 12 psukim of the Torah. That there are other verses in the Bible that are also like the 12 verses in the Bible, meaning that they were written post-Moses. They were written by other prophets. And they were put in to help us understand. In those days, they didn't have footnotes. If the Bible was written today, we would have written a footnote. These are like footnotes that help the reader in his present context better understand the Bible. So Ibn Ezra, like many other scholars of the Middle Ages who did not agree with the Rambam, did not have a theological problem with believing in Torah min Hashemayim that the Bible is divine, and yet a verse here and there is post-Mosaic, that it came from a different prophet. It's not that he believed that whole chunks of the Bible were written post-Mosaic. He didn't believe that. He never says such a thing. But he did believe that one does not undermine the belief in Torah min Hashamayim, that the Bible is divine, by claiming that a verse here and a verse there, a comment here and a comment there, were later glosses that were added by Joshua the prophet, or Yoshiyahu the prophet, or Yirmiyahu the prophet, in order to clarify certain things in the Bible. Now for us, that's a very radical claim. But in the medieval period, there were a whole host, it was clearly a minority position, but there was a whole host of scholars, both in Sfarad and in Ashkenaz, who were willing to entertain that possibility and were not considered heretical. They weren't considered out of the pale or to be attacked or criticized. And so this is what gave the Ibn Ezra that very radical tinge because of these little comments here and there. But the truth is, Ibn Ezra was a very mainstream Parshan in the history of Parshanut. Rashbam, who I think you're going to learn about in one of the sessions, was much more radical than Ibn Ezra in many, many ways. And yet, Ibn Ezra retained this radical impression for generations. So I hope I've enlightened a little bit about the nature of Ibn Ezra and his approach to biblical exegesis, his approach to studying the Bible, and how, you know, the deep assumptions and exegetical approaches that he took. And Ibn Ezra is a hard parshan to read. He's not simple. He mixes a lot of diktuk together with classical stuff. And he also, from time to time, gets into big polemics with the Karaites. And he also, from time to time, makes reference to certain assumptions of the medieval period that are hard for us to relate to about astronomy and alchemy and other things and astrology. But, and that's why you really, thank God, there are some commentaries on Ibn Ezra that help us out. So I hope we learned a little bit about Ibn Ezra tonight, and I hope you continue to enjoy your learning. Have a good evening. If anybody has any questions? Yes. Who was there?
No, the language that
the Canaanites spoke?
Yes.
Some sort of
Hebrew.
I don't know, Hebrew. We today call it a West Semitic dialect because they were in the west of Babylon. So it's a West. The languages of the people around the Jewish, around Israel. Was close to Hebrew, but it was different. There was Phoenician, there was Akkadian, there was Sumerian, there was Ugaritic. These are Semitic languages. They have similarities to Hebrew, but they were, you know, just like in Europe. You could have one country that's right next to another country. There's similarities, but the languages are very different. Right? France and Germany, or France and England are right next to each other, and yet they have very different languages. They have certain common roots. So there were common roots to the ancient Near Eastern languages, but they were different. You and I could not understand Ugaritic, even if we knew Hebrew. You have to study Ugaritic. You have to
study Akkadian, you have to study Sumerian. Yes.
I'm not sure I understood the concept that you said that Ebenezer accepted the aspect of on halacha, you have to follow certain rules in terms of the tikkun. But when it came to parshanut, or before shin or perishin, we didn't have to.
No,
Haggadah.
Right. In the legal portion of the chumash.
Right.
See, everything starts like this.
But either God wrote it with one set of rules, or he didn't.
No.
It was written vis-a-vis halacha, one set of rules, and vis-a-vis...
You're asking me about Rashbam, not about Ibn Ezra.
No,
let me make it very clear. I'm sorry if I wasn't so clear.
No,
Ibn Ezra believed that when it came to the narrative portion of Chumash, there was no authentic tradition going back to Sinai telling us what happened. Meaning, the Benot Slavchad come and say, we want a portion. So the Medrash asks, who was Slavchad? So the Medrash believed in the principle of conservation of personality. Right? Like conservation of energy. So Slavchad was the Mekoshesh Eitzim. Slavchad, right? They try to identify anonymous characters. But who says that? Is that some sort of tradition that goes back to Sinai? Or was that simply the rabbi's conjecture? So Ibn Ezra comes from the tradition of the Gaonim that says there is no authoritative tradition when it comes to that. When it comes to narrative portions that don't change how I'm going to act as a Jew tomorrow morning, it doesn't matter what you believe. You have to follow what makes most sense in the text. Maybe, but when it came to halacha, which he was a practicing believing Jew, if you think about the can of worms you open up, you're faced with the Karaites. The Karaites say, there is no authentic tradition. That's exactly the debate between the Rabbinites and the Karaites, between normative rabbinic Judaism and not. Ibn Ezra believed that we have authentic tradition about how we are supposed to live our life. Now he had to square a circle, and the circle is, he also came from a literary tradition which said that a text has one meaning. So when it comes to narrative portions, it doesn't really matter if I reject Chazal and I say, Yitzchak was 13, he wasn't 37, and that's what it means, na'ar. Because it doesn't change how I'm going to behave. But when it comes to ayin tachat ayin, then it's going to change. So he's being consistent. He says, the text has to mean one thing. In this case, it means whatever it means based on diktuk, etc. So he's also going to try as much as possible in halachic portions to work the same principles. He already told you that when you have authentic tradition, we all agreed that there's truth in life which is passed on from generation to generation by authentic tradition.
You have to say it halachically because otherwise you'd be stuck.
Correct. But he tried
building a logical pyramid that because you have to.
Correct. He comes to the text with certain ideological assumptions, like we all do, whether you wear a kippah or you don't wear a kippah, whether you're a Karai or a Rabbinite. Anybody that comes to a text is coming with a certain set of theological assumptions. And Ibn Ezra and Natty Helfstadt or anybody else is no different. Whether you are a lobster-eating, Yom Kippur smoking Jew, or whether you're a Haredi Jew, you come to a text with certain assumptions. So he came with his assumptions, but at the same time he tried, to the best of his ability, to fit that in with his assumption about how literary works make meaning. Okay? But you do the same thing, and I do the same thing, and a Reform Jew does the same thing, and a Christian style the same thing,
But he doesn't say it's all in the Shemayim. He said, I'm doing it. To say that I'm building it up, that this is what our Kaddish Baruch
Because I believe in a
concept.
Because that's what I believe Torah Shabbat. Because I believe in the reality of a Torah Shabbat Peh.
But then you have to believe it in all senses.
So what?
You can't say I can believe it for one. I'm going to believe it for a lot of.
Who told you that? Who told you that? You come with a certain assumption.
Inconsistent.
What are you talking about? You're not saying correct. Listen, where in the Talmud does it ever claim that believing that Yitzchak was 37 years old comes from Sinai? It never says that. But it does say, halacha l'moshe b'sinai. The Talmud makes claims about halacha. It never makes claims about a God. That's where Ibn Ezra's coming from. Ibn Ezra's coming from the Gaonic tradition, which makes it very clear that when it comes to halacha, how broad halacha is exactly a question that we can debate. And Ibn Ezra limited it. Ibn Ezra says, authentic tradition is this box of 68 things. And those 68 things, or whatever it is, I have to fit into the text and show how they work with dictum, and show how they work with logic. And when they don't work with logic and they don't work with dictum, that's a sign that it's not an authentic tradition. It's a daxiyachid, right, I mentioned before, or it was really by tradition, but it's not that the rabbis really were telling me that's what it means. A very subtle difference. But Agadah is never claimed. Where does it say that the stories that were told in the Gemara are claimed to be from Sinai?
We have Yeshua, whether the walls went down or not, or how at the time.
That's a story, but where does it ever have the term Agadah emotion in Sinai? No such term in the corpus. The corpus never makes that claim. Now, I'm not saying that later on in Jewish history.
The Gemara makes the claim at times very clearly.
That what?
If you don't believe in this, this is not a. And it doesn't necessarily be halacha.
Like what? The Gemara makes three claims. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin says there are three things you have to believe in, and if not, you don't have a chelek oil mado. One is Ha'omer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. Whatever that means. What does the word Torah there mean? I don't know. Does Torah mean Chamisha Chumshik Torah? Tanakh? Aseret HaDibros? The word Torah means 10 different things in the corpus of rabbinic literature. Then the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, Ha'omer Ein Techiyah HaMeisim Min HaTorah. And Ha'omer It never says Ha'omer that every Agadah and Shas you have to believe is from Sinai. Nowhere in the corpus does it make such a faith claim. Now it's true, and it's not in the Rambam either. The Rambam was the greatest advocate of saying that not every Agadah should be taken as authoritative, right? Rambam says those are foolish people who say things like that. You have to interpret many of them. Now, later on in Jewish history, there were people who may have claimed that. Just like today, there are Jews who claim that Rashi is Beruach HaKodesh. But Rashi never made that claim. Where in his corpus did he ever say, I wrote Beruach HaKodesh? Never said that. Rashi never claimed anything like that. In fact, Rashi says, Einani Yodea, three times in his commentary. So, I know that there are Jews later on in history, but that's not what the corpus itself claims. But when it comes to halacha, the corpus itself claims that we are speaking here authoritatively about traditions going back to Sinai. Now, if you accept the corpus, then you have to accept some of its foundational clauses. Now, how much of it is Sinai that you can have a machlokes?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
In practice in Jewish life?
No. Now, it may be that somebody reading them later on in history would say, oh, if this is true, then maybe, you know, like the character in the Chaim Potok novel. Meaning, Ibn Ezra was a God-fearing, pious, practicing Jew who put on tefillin every day and kept Shabbos and all that. And or the Rashbam, even with all his radical stuff. But someone who then runs with the football will say, well, Ibn Ezra said there are three or four verses in the Bible that are post-Mosaic. I think there are 50,000 verses. Ibn Ezra never claimed that. But once you open the Pandora's box, someone could theoretically run with that. But that's not what Ibn Ezra claimed. But, yeah. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everybody.